Chapter 16. Eventually, the train brought them to Hyperion's hollow heart. The moon had been cored deliberately by linking together numerous natural inclusions and then smoothing over and armoring the walls. The train detached from its rails and became a tiny independent spacecraft drifting into the void. The void contained two things. In the middle was a translucent sphere of dark blue glass, several tens of meters across. Etched on the surface of the glass, and glowing with a gentle white light, was a vastly complex pattern of looping lines and knots. Floating off to one side of the sphere was a darker form, elongated and metallic, which Chiku at first took to be a spaceship, imprisoned in the moon's heart. But it was not a ship. The form, rounded at the front, gradually broadened along its flexing, undulating length. A pair of flippers was positioned about halfway between the front and the middle, beyond which the form began to narrow and taper, culminating in what was unmistakably a fluke, shaped like the crescent moon, at the other end. As this thing adjusted its position, flippers paddling vacuum, Chiku realized that she was looking at a spacesuit designed for a whale.
"Arethusa," Gleb announced, "your guests have arrived, if you can bear to be drawn away from your work for a little while."
The voice that replied was soft, feminine. It sounded as though it belonged not to a whale, but to a small Chinese girl with an aptitude for scholarship.
"This is the one with a strange new interest in crucible."
"Jun Wing, believed her," Kwame said. "That is reason enough for me to trust her."
"She's met Eunice and the Tantos,"
Gleb added.
"Met?"
"She has a counterpart on the holoship. They've exchanged memories."
"Fascinating. And thank you, Gleb, for taking care of them. I didn't mean to get engrossed. Bring them closer, will you? But beware of the beam. We don't want anyone getting sliced into sections."
"I'll do my best."
Following Gleb's directions, they veered closer to Arethusa. Chiku was reminded of a piece of early space-age film footage she had seen, of a long-spined, round-headed spaceship disgorging a tiny, spherical, extravehicular module, like a bauble with claws. She felt as vulnerable near Arethusa as the astronaut in that module must have felt. So much mass, so little protection. When one of the flippers twitched, she flinched instinctively against the expected backwash as articulated armor slid over itself in an ingenious, pressure-tight configuration. But of course there was no water. Just a near vacuum, salted with some noble gases.
"You are Chiku, of course. And Pedro, were you with her on Venus when she died?"
"Nearby," Chiku said.
"How sorry I am to learn of it, Imris. She meant a lot to both of us. I watched what you did with the bodies. When she reaches the rings, she'll make her mark."
"I think she already made her mark,"
Imris said. "I also think she was murdered."
"I agree. She communicated her concerns to me on many occasions, and I shared mine with her, of course. We both had our coping strategies. This was mine. Sanctuary. Secrecy. Immersion in my art. Do you like the sphere?"
"It's very pretty," Chiku said.
"I'm very pleased with it. The globe's center is precisely co-aligned with Hyperion's center of mass. The mismatch is never more than millimeters, even with the coming and going of spaceships and people to spoil our little moon's equilibrium. You're aware of our chaotic dynamics. Hyperion tumbles quite unpredictably as Titan and the other moons push and pull on it. There's a value in chaos theory, a number called the Lyapunov exponent, which tells you how to predict a chaotic system's boundary. It's knowledge horizon, if you like. Hyperion's Lyapunov exponent is just 40 days. We can't predict this moon's motion beyond the next 40 days. That's the maximum limit of our foreknowledge. If my life depended on this moon's motion, I would still not be able to say a word about its state beyond 40 days.
What's this beam you mentioned? Chiku said.
A laser, projecting from the wall of the enclosing chamber. You can't see it, of course, because we're in a vacuum. Also, its focus is very tight. Where it touches the blue sphere, it etches a pit in the glass, which shows up as a white discoloration, except it's never a pit, because the laser is fixed to the chamber, and the chamber is always moving, always turning one way or another, because of Titan's torque. So the laser etches a track, a memory in glass, of Hyperion's history.
Chiku studied the blue globe with renewed attention. The white lines she understood now were all one line, a groove that encoded Hyperion's movements over some lengthy interval. The line looped all over the globe, like a scribble of wool. There were bands and patches where the white line had come back over and over again, almost retracing itself. And if it did indeed retrace itself, it would only be for some short distance, before the chaotic uncertainties built up and sent it off on a deviant trajectory. Less than 40 days. Parts of the sphere were almost totally white. Equally, there were regions where the line had never travelled. Seas and inlets of blue, untrammeled by the laser's crossing.
When I'm faced with a difficult decision, Arethusa said, I sometimes let the moon decide for me. I select an area of the sphere and let Hyperion decide whether or not it etches the line through that part. I abdicate my life to chance.
Why would you do that? Chiku asked.
To outfox Arachne. Chance trumps her every time. She may be an Arctilect and a very clever one, but she still can't beat Lyapunov.
She's the reason we're here, Chiku said.
June and I both knew that Arachne would act to protect herself if she felt threatened. June was always very careful, but she must have made some mistake and drawn too much attention to herself.
Perhaps it was my fault, Chiku said. And the possibility of this, now that she had voiced it, sounded entirely likely to her. When I got the new memories, I started making inquiries, especially aboard the loop liner on our way to Venus. I wanted to know more about Junewing and about Arachne. At the time, they were just innocent data searches via the public nets.
I'm sure you acted as prudently as you could, given what you knew at the time.
That's the problem. There's still so much I don't know.
I can clarify the situation, perhaps, make plain the direness of our predicament, but I'm not sure a solution is within our reach. It lies beyond our Lyapunov horizon, at the very least.
Tell me what you know.
Tell me what you know, to begin with, starting with Ocula.
I don't know much. Arachne was built, created, to run the instrument to collate its data. It detected Crucible, and the alien structure on the surface of that planet.
But June told me all that's a mirage.
Not all of it. The planet orbiting 61 Virginis F is quite real, and its surface conditions are sufficiently Earth-like to support human life. All that was verified by independent observation long ago. The holoships aren't going to arrive around a lump of radiation-blasted rubble, or no planet at all. But Mandala, that's a lot more debatable.
But we've also sent holoships to other solar systems, Pedro said.
That's true, but the motivating impulse for this entire wave of interstellar exploration was Mandala. Without that discovery, the Chibesa principle probably wouldn't have been disclosed for decades to come. Mandala set this whole thing in motion.
Chiku sighed. So that's it then. Mandala isn't real, and the providers we sent to Crucible are lying to us about it.
It's more complicated than that,
Arethusa said.
The providers are transmitting false data. There's no doubt about that. But Mandala isn't part of the lie. Mandala exists.
How can you know all this? Pedro cut in. Chico's had these memories for a few days, and she's been rushing around trying to learn what she can and make sense of it all. But it's as if you and June have been sitting on this knowledge all along.
It's one thing to suspect a lie, but quite another to know what is being concealed. Getting to the bottom of that has just cost June Wing her life.
I thought she was putting together a museum, Chiku said.
That was just a cover for her activities. Racing around the solar system hunting for relics provided June with the excuse she needed to go about her real work.
Which was? Pedro asked.
I'll answer that, but you need to know a little about Ocula to begin with. Before the instrument came online, Eunice and I inserted a blind spot in its architecture. Arachne is, or was, the spider at the center of the web, collecting data sent back from the individual elements of the ocular array. That's all she knew. But we were sensible enough not to put all our faith in an artifact. And as a sanity check, once in a very great while, each of those elements was also programmed to squirt raw data packets somewhere else.
Anywhere in particular? Asked Chiku.
To anything Arachne wouldn't notice that could store those data packets. Half-forgotten networks, addressing dormant or semi-derelict archives. Anything with their memory. Moribund offshore bank accounts floating in the asteroid belt. Deep space network routers still up and running. Military encryption devices. Space probes and landers with a trickle of electrical power still running through their circuits. Dead astronauts drifting through space, but whose spacesuits still had some functionality. They weren't our only failsafes, but they gave June a pretext for the rest of her activities. Were we being unreasonably cautious? Paranoid even? It's entirely possible.
So these devices, Pedro said, they stored the data before she got hold of it. So all you have to do is put it all together and you can see the real picture?
Unfortunately, we could only hide the tiniest, tiniest fraction of the full ocular data stream. But the packets are useful. And they do provide more information beyond the fact that she was lying. Put together, they form a kind of reverse filter. We can apply it to selected volumes of the public ocular data and begin to work out which areas were tampered with.
The relic on Venus, the thing Galician brought up from Mars, Chiku said. These are all parts of the puzzle, aren't they?
Actually, the Venus lander was a red herring. It never held any ocular packets. But June was very interested in the Evolvarium object, the Indian Space Agency probe. You brought it with you, didn't you? You met Galician.
We have it, Chiku said. It should be with your specialist by now, Imris Kwame announced.
It can't be this simple, Chiku said, shaking her head. The final jigsaw piece can't magically fall into place now that I'm here. Things don't work that way.
They do, this time, Chiku. You see, you are the final piece of the jigsaw.
Another part of Hyperion had been spun up for the provision of gravity. They were assigned rooms there and given access to a lounge with a surfeit of turquoise carpeting. The lounge's huge curving walls were glass-framed with bolted strips of brassy metal. Beyond the glass, receding away into murk, was a lavishly stocked aquarium. Swimmers and aquatics were navigating towering, castle-like formations of rock and coral, slipping through banners of vivid green kelp. Chiku also saw machines and fish, and a bio-engineered whale that had once been a woman. They could see her true cetacean form now, unencumbered by armor. Arethusa had divested herself of the spacesuit when she returned to her preferred medium. Perhaps she felt at ease with revealing her true self now that she knew herself to be among friends. Gleb had brought green chai. It was just the three of them, Imris Kwame having taken his leave to check on Gulliver's refueling. Gleb moved easily under gravity. The pull here was not much greater than that on Mars, but he looked so strong that Chiku doubted that he would have had too much difficulty, even on Earth.
I've been thinking, Arethusa said, speaking to them from beyond the glass, that it's time to reopen negotiations with Mekufi. I may have some information he'll consider valuable, but he's going to have to prove himself to me first. I'll formulate a mot, and you will convey it to Mekufi. Mekufi, in turn, will assist in your return to Africa. Safe passage will be arranged to the household. When you arrive, you will use your Akinya identity to access the fully reconstructed crucible imagery. Mekufi will also provide the necessary expertise required to transmit your findings to Chiku Green. If he fails in either task, we will not speak again.
Do I really have to go all the way back to Earth? Pedro asked. I mean, I've nothing against the place, but...
The ocular control architecture will only allow Chiku access at the household. Until then, we have only this partial reconstruction. Are you ready to see it?
I think so, Chiku said.
Part of the aquarium wall clouded into opacity, and an image formed on the glass, rendered in two dimensions. It was a view of Crucible, seen from space. Chiku remembered a similar picture in Ndege's Companion, the promise of that waiting world rendered with all the exacting pious clarity of some medieval conception of heaven.
Wait, she said slowly. This is the doctored or undoctored image. I'm confused. It looks the way I was expecting.
At the limits of our correctional resolution, there are no significant points of deviation,
Arethusa said. Okay, now I am really confused.
Look closer. At the time this image was captured, the provider should have already been preparing the groundwork for the surface communities, clearings, trenches, artificial harbors, but there's no evidence of them.
Maybe they're too small to be seen from space, Pedro said.
Traces of the works were easily visible in the doctored imagery. I admit there is some room for error here, but I can state with a fairly high level of confidence that there are no new cities awaiting you on Crucible. The providers haven't built them. That much, at least, is a lie.
Dear God, Chiku said, how are they expecting us to react when we arrive in orbit?
There's no guarantee that the holoships will reach orbit. The providers will have ample opportunity to prevent your arrival. A relatively simple weapon, deployed from the cover of a planetary surface, could easily hole a holoship, the kind of thing you might use to shoot down meteors.
Is this the worst of it? Chiku asked. I was almost expecting Mandala to be a figment of Arachne's imagination.
I'm afraid there's more to tell.
The image zoomed out a little. Chiku frowned. Until then, her view of Crucible had been unobstructed, exactly as if she were in orbit looking down. But now, there were clots of darkness around the planet, organized into a kind of equatorial ring that cut across her view. The ring was lumpy, its edges fuzzy. It was difficult to make out definite detail.
Tell me what we're seeing, Chiku said.
We are looking now at the areas of the image, or more properly, the three-dimensional space around Crucible, where I am certain Arachne has distorted the data. In other words, there is something in space, perhaps in orbit around the planet, that she has chosen to conceal from us.
A ring? Like around Saturn? Pedro asked.
It's possible, although I cannot see why she would be motivated to hide a natural feature. More likely, and given the artificial nature of Mandala, this is also some evidence of intelligence. It could be one structure, or perhaps an assemblage of smaller structures. I can't say more than that for certain.
They must be huge, whatever they are, Chiku said.
Indeed.
Bigger than anything we could ever hope to make. Even if we took all the holoships, packed them in a necklace around Crucible.
This is frightening, Pedro said. I'm not even on the holoship and I'm terrified.
He squeezed her hand.
I'm sorry. This is worse for you.
It is catastrophic for all of us,
Arethusa said.
Our entire civil society is constructed on an implicit assumption that we can trust the artificial intelligences, the mechanism, the providers. We have never once questioned whether these things have our best interests at heart.
I still don't understand, Pedro said. Why would Arachne create this illusion? If she was going to hide the existence of an alien artifact, why not go all the way and hide Mandala as well?
She needed to give us the impetus to go to Crucible in the first place, Chiku said. She's an artificial intelligence, not a physical thing.
But she must have known that if we sent machines to Crucible, she could transmit a part of herself along at the same time. It's speculation, I know. But here's the thing I really don't have an answer for. What the hell is it that she doesn't want us to see?
In another part of Hyperion, Gleb was waiting for Chiku with a small Chinese schoolgirl. The schoolgirl wore a red dress, white socks, and black shoes, polished to an extreme mirror-like finish. It was either a figment or a proxy of Arethusa, manifesting in her former incarnation of Lin Wei.
"You can leave us for a while, Gleb,"
Lin Wei said, pleasantly enough. Now that the terms of their departure had been settled, Chiku was anxious to be aboard the ship and on her way back to Earth. But when Lin took her into a green-tiled room with no windows, a room that felt astringent and medical, even though there were no chemicals or machines anywhere in sight, she began to have her suspicions. "Why am I here?" Chiku asked, with a shiver of foreboding.
"You know why. Mekufi showed you the remains of Memphis, the ship that came back, and the version of you he found aboard it. Beyond that, you don't know very much. The ship was damaged, its records scrambled, your counterpart frozen beyond safe revival. You couldn't ask her what had happened. All you knew was what Mekufi told you, that she had come home alone, without the prize."
"That just about sums it up."
"Did you think to wonder what had happened to Eunice?"
"I know what happened to Eunice. She's with the Tantos."
"I'm talking about your real flesh and blood great-grandmother, the woman who was born in Tanzania, back when people still thought burning coal was a good idea."
"No one knows where she is. She was on that ship, heading into deep space. Maybe my counterpart discovered the truth out there, or maybe she didn't. Mekufi couldn't even tell me whether Memphis had managed to dock with Winter Queen."
"She did manage to dock. I know, because I left sensors on Winter Queen after my own visit that told me when another ship approached and docked."
"Are you saying that you got there before Chiku read?"
"One ship reached Eunice's craft. Is it beyond the bounds of possibility that another vessel got there sooner?"
"For a start, we were watching. Secondly, you're a whale."
"I didn't need to go out there in person. I sent a probe, an uncrewed ship. We panspermians have never liked robots, but there are times when we have had no choice but to use them. This was one such occasion. The ship was very swift, very clever, very dark. By the time you'd started to dream up your ambitious publicity stunt, I was already on my way. I sent my ship off in a totally different direction until it was too far out for you or anyone else to reliably track its drive flame, and only then vectored the ship onto Eunice. Of course, it didn't hurt that the only instrument capable of detecting that kind of activity was ocular, my very own plaything."
"So you got there first,"
Chiku said, angry, but at the same time accepting that what was done was done.
"My robots found her. She was still in the cryopreservation casket, which he entered not long after her departure from the solar system in 2101. She was dead."
"Frozen, you mean?"
"Frozen and dead. Far beyond any hope of clinical revival. Every cell in her body had been ruptured by expanding ice crystals, her brain structure demolished. Something had gone terribly wrong. Not that she ever expected to get anywhere. Just heading out aboard that ship was a good enough goad and a lure for the rest of us."
After a lengthy silence, Chiku said, "So, did your robots bring her home? That was the point of sending them there, wasn't it?"
"Yes. They brought her home. Would you like to see her?"
"I'm not sure."
"Because you don't think you're ready for it? I think you are. I've kept her on ice since my robots returned. The cellular damage is extensive, but the visible effects, they are not as severe as you might imagine. I think you should see your great-grandmother, Chiku. And then, I'll tell you about the other thing I found aboard Winter Queen."
"What other thing?"
"Let me show you her body first."
Part of the green tiled wall slid out and extended out into the room. With it came a shock of cold, a front so sharp and sudden and merciless that it drew tears. Chiku hugged her arms around her torso. The air felt like shovel loads of ice going down her throat. Lin Wei, in her red dress and stockings, looked on with lofty disregard.
"Go to her, but don't touch. You'll hurt yourself."
Eunice was resting on a green platform. She was on her back, dressed in the inner layer of a spacesuit, her arms crossed over her chest, her head tilted back in serene repose. Her eyes were closed, her expression restful. The ice glittered on her skin. It was lovely, those little, glinting crystals against her skin, a spray of stars in the Milky Way. She looked only a little older than the construct, but not by decades. She had been at the start of her 8th decade when she entered the casket, and assuming she had not spent long periods awake after Winter Queen's departure, this was the age she had been at her death. There were marks on her skin, deep black bruises, and elsewhere a kind of pale, bloodless frosting. Chiku could not say how much of this was due to age, and how much the fault of the cryogenic accident that had damaged her cells. Above all else, she did not appear to be beyond the hope of revival. But a wax model would look just as viable, Chiku reminded herself. The eye could not discern the gross destruction that had taken place on the microscopic level, where it really mattered.
"We scanned and recorded those neural structures that were still resolvable,"
Lin Wei said.
"Traces and ghosts of traces, really. But you are welcome to the data. And to the body, if you would like it."
"Like doesn't sound quite the right word."
"If you feel you must return her to Africa, I won't stop you."
"I won't take her," Chiku said. "Not now. But I will have those neural patterns."
"For you?"
"For someone I know." She traced a hand along Eunice's contours, not quite touching, but feeling in her palm the meniscus of cold clinging to the corpse. She would be warming slightly, Chiku supposed, just by being in this room, a little more damage to add to the harm already done. Lin Wei would not have exposed the body to the room's temperature, had there been any real prospect of revival.
"She made fools of all of us, and gave us the stars in recompense," said Lin Wei. I suppose we can find forgiveness if we dig deeply enough. Now, would you like to hear about the other thing I found on Winter Queen?
Chiku nodded. She could think of very little that would surprise her now. Strange marching figures appeared in the air, like regiments of little stick men. Chiku recognized them for what they were. It was essentially the same alien alphabet that Eunice had used when she engraved her memory wall. Symbols of the Chibeza syntax.
Let me clarify,
Lin Wei said.